I decided to challenge a sitting Democratic incumbent for his congressional seat in the 2000 election cycle. It was an ill-considered race, and I lost badly, the sort of drubbing that awakens you to the fact that life is not obliged to work out as you'd planned. At some point, I arrived at an acceptance of my limits, and in a way, my mortality. I refocused on my work in the state Senate and took satisfaction from the reforms and initiatives that my position afforded. I spent more time at home and watched my daughters grow and properly cherished my wife and thought about my long-term financial obligations. I exercised and read novels and came to appreciate how the earth rotated around the sun and the seasons came and went without any particular exertions on my part. And it was this acceptance, I think, that allowed me to come up with the thoroughly cockeyed idea of running for the United States Senate. An up-or-out strategy was how I described it to my wife. One last shot to test out my ideas before I settled into a calmer, more stable, and better-paying existence. And she, perhaps more out of pity than conviction, agreed to this one last race, though she also suggested that given the orderly life she preferred for our family, I shouldn't necessarily count on her vote. Freed from worry by low expectations, my credibility bolstered by several helpful endorsements, I threw myself into the race with an energy and joy that I thought I had lost. I hired 4 staffers, all of them smart, in their 20s or early 30s, and suitably cheap. We found a small office, printed letterhead, installed phone lines and several computers. 4 or 5 hours a day, I called major Democratic donors and tried to get my calls returned. I held press conferences, to which nobody came. We signed up for the annual St. Patrick's Day parade and were assigned the parade's very last slot, so that my 10 volunteers and I found ourselves marching just a few paces ahead of the city's sanitation trucks, waving to the few stragglers who remained on the route, while workers swept garbage and peeled green shamrock stickers off the lampposts. Mostly, though, I just traveled, often driving alone, first from ward to ward in Chicago, then from county to county and town to town, eventually up and down the state, across miles and miles of cornfields and bean fields and train tracks and silos. It wasn't an efficient process. Without the machinery of the state's Democratic Party organization, without any real mailing list or internet operation, I had to rely on friends or acquaintances to open up their houses to whomever might come, or to arrange for my visit to their church, union hall, bridge group, or rotary club. Sometimes, after several hours of driving, I would find just 2 or 3 people waiting for me around a kitchen table. I would have to assure the hosts that the turnout was fine, and compliment them on the refreshments they'd prepared. Sometimes I would sit through a church service and the pastor would forget to recognize me, or the head of the local union would let me speak to his members just before announcing that the union had decided to endorse someone else. But whether I was meeting with 2 people or 50, whether I was in one of the well-shaded, stately homes of the North Shore, a walk-up apartment on the West Side, or a farmhouse outside Bloomington, whether people were friendly, indifferent, or occasionally hostile, I tried my best to keep my mouth shut and hear what they had to say. I listened to people talk about their jobs, their businesses, the local school, their anger at Bush and their anger at Democrats, their dogs, their back pain, their war service, and the things they remembered from childhood. Some had well-developed theories to explain the loss of manufacturing jobs or the high cost of health care. Some recited what they'd heard on Rush Limbaugh or NPR. But most of them were too busy with work or their kids to pay much attention to politics, and they spoke instead of what they saw before them. A plant closed, a promotion, a high heating bill, a parent in a nursing home, a child's first step. No blinding insights emerged from these months of conversation. If anything, what struck me was just how modest people's hopes were, and how much of what they believed seemed to hold constant across race, region, religion, and class. Most of them thought that anybody willing to work should be able to find a job that paid a living wage. They figured that people shouldn't have to file for bankruptcy because they get sick. They believed that every child should have a genuinely good education, that it shouldn't just be a bunch of talk, and that those same children should be able to go to college, even if their parents weren't rich. They wanted to be safe from criminals and from terrorists. They wanted clean air, clean water, and time with their kids. And when they got old, they wanted to be able to retire with some dignity and respect.